Welcome to Foundation Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Foundation on Apple TV+. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we are here today to do a very special interview, our second special interview of the season, with Mr. David S. Goyer. Aaron, what can you tell me about this guy, if you don't already
know? He's an executive producer, writer, director, and showrunner of Apple TV Plus's Foundation. David Goyer's back on the podcast. Let's get right to it. Let's check in. I guess we'll open it with, like, this is the eve of the airing of the season two finale of Foundation. How are you feeling heading into that, about the season overall, about this finale?
I'm feeling pretty good. I feel like we were able to accomplish everything we set out to accomplish this season in terms of course correcting a few things that I wanted to course correct, getting more creative runway from Skydance and Apple, because they were, you know, they definitely gave me more rope, hopefully not myself, this season. So I had a very intentional sort of set of things I wanted to try to adjust and or hit this season. And I feel like in almost every circumstance, the audience has responded actually better than I hoped. I mean, I'm happy, you know, knock wood. And it's been interesting also, because of this strike, I have been able to engage on Reddit or, you know, with you guys, just a lot more than I might normally have been able to. And so that's been really fun for me. And I've been able to kind of monitor in real time fan theories and whatnot. And it's been cool, because I think most of the time where the preponderance of the audience felt we were going to zig, we zagged, which is a pleasure experience, you know, as a showrunner, to feel like we're kind of keeping people on their toes. And so I think that we definitely did some things in the final episode, that I think break some of the structural conventions that you would expect from premium television. A lot of big things still happened in episode 10. So I don't know. How do you guys feel?
Yeah, a lot of times that'll be kind of a denouement or whatever, right? To set the next season. This does have some huge developments for sure.
Yeah.
I think this season, we just recorded our review of the finale episode yesterday. I think this season is a very confident step forward in almost every aspect of the first season. And you know, obviously from our coverage, I thought the first season was good, really good. And like, the only knock was like maybe some of the plots weren't as developed as the others. And this, like, you know, we said many times this season, like, I feel like everything was just firing on all cylinders. Every single plot line, every single character, everything was kind of crackling. The finale was a reversion of subversions of the things in episode 9. And yeah. So where I've laid on it is, like, when I first watched it, I felt like, you know, a good friend had come in and been like, Aaron, your car's been stolen. And I'm like, oh, you know, like after episode 9, right? I'm like, my God, what am I going to do? How am I going to get to work? What are the implications of this? I got to call the insurance agent. I got to call the police. I got to do all this. And in episode 10, my buddy came in and was like, actually, I just parked it up the street. And I've been had, but I don't know. It's like, is it a funny? It's like, and I'm like, okay, it's a pretty funny joke, and he played fair, and he didn't. And I think I've come around, but my first instinct was like, oh, I thought the foundation was gone. I thought I was like curious to see how Harry's going to get out of this and how they're going to do a third. What? And then it was kind of all subverted, and it took me a minute to kind of like get over my initial, like, ah, oh, shit, my car was stolen.
That's fair. I think some people, it's interesting. I suspect a big chunk of the audience will be enormously relieved that the preponderance of the people survived, you know?
Characters they care about, yeah.
Yeah, characters they care about. Although, if you really think about it, though, you know, other than Polly and Cermak, you know, a lot of the characters they care about are on the ship, are not on Terminus.
And then, you still kill a lot of the ones that I cared about.
That's the flip side of it, right? Is it schmuck bait if then you, because part of what we were trying to do was with the whole Terminus thing is it was Harry and to a lesser extent Hober's plan from the beginning, right? To do this whole shell game to bait Empire into bringing, you know, the fleet to do the enclosure, to destroy the planet, which gives him incredibly good cover for the next 100 years.
Sure.
And, you know, we set up the vaults bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, you know, kind of all of these things. So I felt like we played fair. And it's been interesting as well, because a lot of people are like, you know, don't kill your gays. But then I'm like, but we didn't kill Glaewyn. We did the reverse. But then we killed a ton of other characters. And so I think if we had saved the people on Terminus and, you know, saved Hober and saved Bell and say, like, I feel like that would have been schmuck bait.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Because you're laying out the exact logic that I laid out in a podcast yesterday. I'm walking through. It's like, you know,
really?
It's got all these elements of the crime, but it lacks intent. And also the cost. Like, I've never seen schmuck bait where it's like huge main characters that I care. Like, I like I said, I felt devastated, you know, that like Hober and Bell weren't going to get out of this.
Yeah.
It like, especially Hober and that stuff with Salvor was brutal. And yeah. And Harry's reaction to it, it felt, and I had an intense emotional reaction of relief when I saw, like, I got like choked up when Polly came out. I got choked up when Constance's dads came out.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then I got choked up when Glaewyn came out. And then when the music swelled and you just came up and up and up and you see all these people that Harry has saved, I got choked. And that's like oh God, thank God my car's not stolen. Right. So it's like that to me, it's like, and I don't know if you listened to our 9, but as we were, you know, we were saying out about it, a bunch of stuff that could happen in the finale. It's like, you know, wouldn't it be funny if they just jump back into cryopods? Wouldn't it be funny if Harry actually has some plan to like warp Trantor out to someplace? And we're like, but you know, you can do anything as long as you do it well. Mm. And doing it well is all about honoring the characters, honoring the audience's faith. And I thought that's where I arrived with the finale, that it was shocking and it was like audacious and it rolled back a lot of things I thought were true in 9. But you didn't play false and it worked on me, and you definitely paid the iron price in game. I mean, like, you killed more main characters in your average Game of Thrones season.
We killed six main characters in our season finale.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it's interesting. Apple released something on Instagram. I think it was a picture of four of the characters and said one will fall. And all of them fall. in that and I knew that, you know, and we didn't, by the way, we didn't do it just to shock people, but I think here's the thing. I mean, we took a big swing in 9 and we took a, I think in its own way, an equally big swing in 10, and it's, you know, It's interesting. Like, I was on Reddit and there were a whole ton of people arguing for all the ways that like Terminus didn't get destroyed.
Right.
You know, and so a lot of people saying like, oh, if all those people are dead, I'm going to be so mad. And then an equal amount of people saying, no, they're dead. We kind of did something in the middle. There are, without giving too much away, there are some very good, we considered that all the people as well. But there are some good reasons down the line for why we ultimately decided we couldn't do that.
Okay.
And then in terms of the deaths, Bell so far, I would say Bell and Hober are my favorite characters, right? And
yeah,
I did not want to kill him. And I don't think the audience wanted to kill him. But it just felt right. It just felt like the right thing to do. It felt there were some people that were criticizing initially Hober's introduction as being too campy. And my whole point was, even Apple initially, and I said, just wait until we get to the end, because I think the end is a gut punch, what happens between Hober and Bell. And
and that bottle of wine.
Yeah,
it was. Yeah. It worked really well, that scene.
But I think it works because he's, in particular, Hober introduces such a ridiculous, foppish character. And we, but we took that long journey. And so it's just interesting because my experience on the show is, we'll have to see what the audience at large feels about the episode is. But so far, a lot of it's been validated that I tend to play the long game, right, with my characters. Mm-hmm. And so I tend to start a character here at the beginning of a season and like, just wait, you know what I mean? And I tend to, and we were cognizant of even things like, is Harry dead or Salvador dead in the middle of the season, right? But we knew where we were ending. And so we knew by the time we showed that, Salver was alive and 8, that everyone would assume she has armor and that she's not going anywhere, certainly not at the tail end of the 10th episode. And again, we didn't do it for shock value. There were very good reasons why we did it, but I've just decided to not become attached to my characters and do what I feel is right for the story. And sometimes that may not be apparent until a few episodes later, or sometimes even a season later, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, sure.
Well, you just set yourself a challenge to create new characters that people are going to love just as much as the old ones, right?
Well, we did it in season 2.
Exactly, yeah.
So
I have a lot of specific questions stuff because there were 3 big switcheroos that I think I've come most of the way around on them. I had a very emotional reaction when I first watched that finale and felt like a little bit like I had been betrayed. I've come around all the way on the Terminus stuff. I think that stuff was really good.
Because the Terminites survived, but the planet was still destroyed. You felt betrayed there?
Initially, yeah. Yes. But the more I thought about it, the more it made a lot of sense. I mean, the Vault, we've seen the Vault do essentially exactly what it did here, just on a grander scale.
Well, since that can I get to that? Because since it's up in the air, because that's the one that I was shocked. Because like the whole, you kind of subverted, in the books, the whole idea is you have a first foundation and then there's a secret second foundation that's keeping tabs on the first foundation, manipulating things from afar. And the middle of the season, you kind of blew my mind by having Dr. Seldon, the first foundation, find out about the second foundation and like, oh my God, I'm the left hand. This sucks, and I'm like, wow, I wonder how they're going to fix that. And in episode 9, when you destroyed the first foundation, I'm like, oh my God, that fixes the problem. But I think it actually still did. So if I'm putting together the pieces, right, tell me if I'm way off base or not.
Sure.
Here, Dr. Seldon gives the Prime Radiant to Demerzel, which means that there's no longer a conduit for Harry to see into Dr. Seldon's business and vice versa.
Yes.
The rest of the universe is going to think the foundation was destroyed.
Way more so than a mega flare. Yes.
Yeah. And so now you've set up the possibility that the first foundation is going to play the second foundation's roles and now they're going to switcheroo.
You are correct,
okay.
Sir.
Uh-huh. So now, like, that's what made my piece, because like I was so excited to see how you're going to unravel that knot that like when you went back from it, I'm like, well, that kind of that feels a little cheap, but like I think you actually did it. So now I'm very excited to see how you're actually going to do that dance step where the two foundations kind of switch sides a bit.
All things have a cycle. First the podcast, then the ad.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Math is never just numbers, and this isn't just a podcast. We're back with more Foundation.
Well, the obviously we're adapting the books, but we're sort of like the someone in our show, what our show is to the books is like the Marvel Ultimates is to the Marvel Universe or something like that, which I think is a very apt description. There are a whole number of reasons for why we didn't want to completely destroy the first Foundation, but not the least of which is there in the books, there remained tension between the first and the second Foundation for quite a while. And that was just not something we thought about doing it, but that's just not something I was willing to give up yet because there's a lot of mileage, I think, there. And I think there's a lot of mileage in there ultimately being also a conflict between the two Foundations and a conflict between the two parents, which is not something that exists in the book. And so that's something
tease it at the end of the season 10 or episode 10.
Yes. And that is something I'm just as the showrunner really interested in exploring. I think that's really juicy because,
yeah,
you know what, eventually Empire will fall, but the story's not done. And there's that whole argument of like, well, the Foundation continues unabated. It just becomes Empire all over again, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so in some ways, that ultimate struggle is even more interesting to me than the struggle between Foundation and Empire. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm with you. I do wonder how is Dr. Seldon, like, I do wonder now that you got the two Harrys, how is the Dr. Seldon going to keep his activities hidden from Harry and vice versa, because now you got the reverse situation that Dr. Seldon knows about Harry. Harry doesn't know about Dr. Seldon. I don't know. Maybe it'd be interesting to like hand that baton back and forth throughout the series, but I'm very excited about the possibilities of how this is going to work out.
There are also some other wrinkles to Seldon giving Demerzel the prime radiant that you haven't cited yet. But the ones that you did cite are certainly things that were that we are attacking in that direction.
Yeah. So, so Jim, I'll yield the witness to you for the other 2 points.
Oh, yeah. I have some questions around the other two big switcheroos for sure. So one of the other switcheroos I see is the Spacers did actually make a deal with Hober.
Yeah.
When did that happen? Because the first encounter that they had seemed to go very negatively for this plan. And then we're revealed here in the finale, it actually, they did make a deal.
So we cut away after Hober's making his speech, and she says that, I'm paraphrasing, but Gia Center says that's really interesting, you know, effectively. But if we did this, they would take 20% of our whatnot, our progeny, and we can't allow that. Mm-hmm. And so one can imagine, and we thought about showing this and then decided not to, but the conversation kept going after that. You know, it didn't end there. And so between the time that they, and that's what this was effectively sort of like a biometric, you know, USB drive that had sure. the virus that he, which is why he had to get onto the bridge.
Mm-hmm. That all makes sense. We just didn't see, I guess, the connective tissue.
Well, I guess the question is
to preserve the surprise, right?
Well, for sure to preserve the surprise. And then the question is, we actually wrote that. It was like the scene went on about, I don't know, a page and a half further, right? Between Hober and her, in which it's clear that they start to make a deal. And then we thought about showing that once they're on the bridge and it's like, aha, this, aha, that. It was already such a long scene of like, you knew this and you knew that and you knew that to editorially jump out of it. We just said, I just felt it would have broken the tension, and it was already such a long scene.
There's one confusing thing, like on the, because we go back to Hober and the She Who Is Sent There, and you know, that's the scene where she calls the cops, essentially. It says, nope, yes. No sale, I'm calling the cops. That was a ruse, and I guess who was that scene's benefit for? Or are we supposed to understand that, like, right at the moment that she's got the phone dialing 911, Hober says, "No, wait, there's more," and
the latter,
her.
The latter, yeah,
okay.
That scene wasn't a ruse. It was definitely getting to the point where.
So we just missed a third step of the negotiations.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
And that's what Hober means when he talks about hard selling. You know,
yeah,
he's been selling hard. He's out of breath.
And I think the clue for the audience is, and we picked this up when we were watching it, She Who Sent There takes this unprecedented thing of taking the entire home swarm out to give her daughter, you know, a hug, essentially. And
she wouldn't have done that just to see her.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's also the thing that was also interesting, because people are saying, oh, I guess, you know, Harry meant for Hober to fail. He didn't fail. Their plan worked. Just that we weren't, you know, effectively what we were trying to do was, you know, and I saw a lot of theorizing as to whether or not they were going to somehow use the castling bracelet to cast population out or whatnot. And someone said, no, but the whole point of the casting bracelet is a rook and a king. And we stayed true to that, right? Rook and a king. Like, that's just a one-to-one thing. We weren't going to do anything. But we did, in a way, castle the Terminus people away. I mean, thematically. And so the, you know, Seldon's plan was twofold. It was to send Polly and Constant to Terminus to bait and anger Day. He fully expected that they would discover the sliver of his consciousness, you know, inside. That was all to plan. And to send Hober to the Spacers with the manufactured obelisk and make a deal that would destroy the 20th Fleet and then buy, you know, the power of transitive storytelling, you know, effectively create, you know, a galaxy-wide mutiny, right? That having been said, Seldon had no expectation that Polly and Constant would live. So he did. He didn't put their heads on the chopping block. And so I'm curious to see how people feel about him at the end, because he saved a ton of people, but he also, everyone on the Invictus was sacrificed. Like he knew they couldn't win that fight. He put them out. So it's his plan worked to plan, you know, but he saved a lot of people, but he also sacrificed a lot of people and he lied to a lot of people.
Did the people of the foundation know they were going to, did the people of the foundation know they're going to be saved?
No. And that's, I've seen people wondering whether or not they knew that. No, they didn't.
Okay. Okay.
The people on the Invictus did not know they were sacrificial lambs.
Okay. Interesting.
So is he a good guy? I don't know.
Sure. He reminds me a lot of the Skarsgård figure on Andor, you know?
Yeah.
Where he's like, you know, he's committed to do whatever it takes to shorten the darkness, you know? And if that, he'll grind whatever grist that requires.
Well, yeah. And if you're talking about trillions of people, it's unrealistic. I mean, we might have even talked about this on one of your podcasts, but just think about what the leader, you know, what the president has had to do. Has he ever had to sacrifice troops that he knew was behind enemy lines, or, you know, when the Enigma code may or may not have been cracked, or Normandy, or things like that? I mean, all the time leaders of large populations have to make decisions where they are knowingly condemning, you know, citizens. And if you expand that to trillions of people, yeah, what's a planet? Look, we could have absolutely killed all the population of Terminus. And I think still would have been an interesting thing for, and we talked about it, for Seldon to do. It's just that there's more story we want to tell there. So that's why we did what we did.
Well, it helps that some of the characters we do like Glaywin, are kind of giving their consent here too, right? Yeah, go ahead and destroy this planet because it is for the greater good, right?
Mm-hmm. But I think that's an interesting inversion that Glaywin survives. Everyone, you know, I was having to bite my tongue on that. But would you have wanted, would you guys have wanted, and I know you have more questions, would you have wanted Bell and or Hober to live?
I think yes, but
emotionally, definitely.
That would have been oof, that would have been rough, because it would have seemed very much like magical wave your hand, nothing bad happens to Harry kind of thing. So yeah, I'm glad for the sake of the story and the integrity of the show that steep a cost was paid. And I mean, that's the thing, that's what I got. Choked up at the sight of Glaywin. It's Glaywin's dawning realization, like this relief of like, oh my God, I lived through this thing, but now the foundation winning means that Bell lost. And he's like, it's like, and those guys, oh my God, Ben, and I forget what Glaywin's
Dino, Dino.
You know, I've mentioned it's like the secret sauce there is they'd worked together and had this kind of relationship. And that's such, you know, being able to copy and paste that emotional connection. And I was just so impressed by those guys.
Me too. And it was a genius idea on Ben's part to suggest that we cast, you know, but it's interesting. I mean, I'm sure people will be debating what happens in 10 for a while, which is what you want, right? But is there I'm sure some people were like, well, I wish this character would have lived and that character would have died or this or that. And I think if you're going to take big like this, you're going to take big swings. I don't think, given the situation that we did, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, that it would have been possible to have come up with a big swing ending in which every single person was satisfied. You know, this character died, that character didn't die, this character, you know,
There's one other aspect of the switcheroo stuff that I want to talk about. And it's maybe the one that's bugging me the most, because I feel like I just have very specific questions around it. And it's the fact that Harry lived and how he lived, I guess.
Yes.
We find out that Gale and him have been working together pretty much
since the drowning.
Yeah, since the drowning. I mean, moments after it.
Yeah.
And she is using her powers to kind of disguise the fact that they've been working together, that he's alive at all. Earlier in the season, there was very specific, and even later, there was very specific visual language around that. You guys used a visual effect to kind of convey
certain
things about the powers.
Detuned lens is what we call it.
The detuned lens. I'm curious, what were the rules around that, given what we saw? Because a lot of the times, now in retrospect, I think we should have been seeing that. It didn't feel like we were seeing that.
So do you want, here's the truth.
Okay, please.
we run an incredibly tight ship, generally, on all of this stuff. And we decided that when what we call the mentalic effect was happening, or when an aggressive version of the mentalic effect was happening, because there's probably subtle little nudges happening throughout the day on that planet. But when a really aggressive version of what was happening, we would use these detuned lenses. And so lenses have all of these components, and this particular set of lenses, you know, a lens technician went in and by hand sort of slightly put some of them out of alignment. And that was the effect we would do. And we, over the course of the four directors, said, okay, here are the scenes and moments in which you should use the detuned lenses. And the truth is, and here is when you shouldn't. And I would say over the course of the production, about 80% of the time, they got that right. We got that right. And about 20% of the time, and that is the God's honest truth. And there were scenes in which the detuned lenses were used in which they shouldn't have been, and some other moments in which they were not used in which they should have been. And that's the true answer, and maybe the frustrating answer.
What do you wish the answer was?
Well, no, we didn't get them all right. Yeah, I only directed episodes. Well, that's not true. I directed episodes 2 and 3. And so there were some moments like when they're talking, they're in the cockpit of the beggar and they're talking about Ignis and can you feel it? I used the detuned lenses there. And I ended up directing about a third of episode 4 and a little more than a third of episode 7. And so I got them right in my scenes. and most of the other people got them right. But there were a couple of slip-ups when I wasn't... Because I'm not... we often shoot on 2 full units at once. And there were some screw-ups. But keep going. Sorry.
Okay. No, that was my question. Like, what was that all about? So I think that answers it. All right.
I think we're done. The interrogation phase is over.
That's okay. But again, we tried to play fair with that too. Because we showed a body, you know, and to ground the illusion. And we had the scene in 7 in which Selver, well, we had a couple of scenes in 7 in which Selver comes upon Gil and she's counting prime. She's really agitated. And,
yeah,
you know, we also thought about the obvious solution would have been to have Harry have been a robot.
That was my pet theory, for sure.
Right. And potentially, I think, and we talked through this, an interesting version of that would have been Harry not knowing he's a robot, right?
Yeah, that, totally.
That, and that's a totally valid story to go down. Another version might have been that it was a robot with like an organic brain that they'd grown or something like that. So I guess that might be kind of a cyborg. I mean, this one's hard. We just we certainly talked about that, but for a bunch of reasons that will become obvious, hopefully in season 3, we decided not to do that. So we All right. That one's hard though. Sometimes when you are saying like, yeah, we thought about doing that, and then decided not to for a bunch of storylines.
Yeah, I have no problem with how, like, the decisions you guys made around the story there. That was not the issue. Because I expected Harry to live.
You just felt that some of the detuned lenses weren't properly.
It didn't line up with what I expected to see, given what you told us.
Yeah, he was paying close attention.
You're right. Throughout the season,
yeah.
You're right.
Okay.
You're right.
One of the many enigmatic things that Demerzel... I'm sorry, did you want to elaborate on that?
No.
Okay.
It's all good.
One of the many enigmatic things that Demerzel says this season is that she chose Bel Rios to lead the fleet for a reason. And knowing now everything about Demerzel, I'm curious, what was the reason she chose him? And was she satisfied or not?
Oh, I think after the fact, after what happened, she was very satisfied. She chose Bel because fundamentally she didn't know specifically that he would attempt to betray Empire per se. I mean, she was aware of all of the arguments that Bel made to Klavan, right? She chose Bel because she thought he was moral and an adult in the room. And so that in an incredibly tense series of situations, that he would make morally the best decisions possible. And she also chose Bel because she felt, this is what I believe, this is my headcanon, that if an opportunity arose for him to do the right thing and potentially go against Empire, he would take it.
That was my guess. That, like, even if, okay, can I take it a step further? Was Demerzel in the back of her mind, where her programming couldn't lurk, kind of secretly hoping that Bel could successfully overthrow the Empire and free her? Which would,
for sure, for 100%, for sure.
How much leeway does her programmer give her to do these kind of like paper
cuts?
Well,
that's where... the devil's in the details, right? And that would be
the interpretations
that the audiences can discuss in between season two and season three. Is, as we've seen with the robotic laws, there are nuances, right? I mean, that was why Asimov wrote the robotic laws, and the devil's in the details. And she clearly wants to be free. And so the question is, what's permissible? And, is that by choosing someone that might rebel if they saw the right circumstances, does that mean she's betraying her programming in so far as Clean the First goes? I don't know. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I love that disparity between what she can say and what she can do. She can say, I hate this man, Cleon, but she can't do anything, actually physically do anything. Her program won't let her. And to me, that's super interesting, especially given what we see at the end of this season with her and the Prime Radiant. She says there are wonderful things in our future. For who? For Empire or for her? And I think interesting question.
What I was very pleased with this season was how the audience kept going back and forth on Demerzel. And
yeah,
that may be something that will continue to happen for a while.
I think there's still so much to explore with her.
Yeah.
I have some questions about sort of where we're ending with Harry and Gale. Gale's able to convince Harry to abandon his plan, which I think is the first time that's ever happened, that anyone has talked Harry out of anything. Mm-hmm. She does it sort of by appealing to his ego, which I love. You know, if there's a crisis, Harry Seldon's going to be involved. You're the only one who can deal with that.
Sure.
And then they decide to get into the cryopods, which I think was, this is the second time. We talked about this last time we chatted, how this might be a risky operation. But I think because they made a conscious decision to get into those pods, it's very unoffensive to me. I actually quite like this. My question is, like, how long are they planning to sleep? Are they going with the plan that Harry initially came up with for Gale, where they're going to sleep for a year, wake up, she's going to kind of represent as a goddess there, and they're going to continue that? Or are they sleeping for 150 years, just hoping the Mentallics will take it from here?
Well,
and what can you say about that?
What can I say?
Uh-oh, our dynastic empire is experiencing some genetic drift. We'll be right back. The algorithm says this podcast will continue. Welcome back to Foundation.
The plan is that once a year, they'll wake up for a day, you know, or possibly a week, check in on the state of things. She will, in a way, play the role of goddess, and they will progressively, you know, grow the mentalic population to become the army that they need. That's the plan.
The plan. Okay.
Yeah. But as we know, things don't always go to plan.
Uh-huh.
I just want to add one other thing, which is what we were trying to do with Harry and Gail this season was repair their relationship in a way, is they both lost tremendous loss in their lives, and they are more alike probably than any two other people in the galaxy, right? So we were trying to create this, by the end of the season, this father-daughter relationship, and even have Harry open up his heart to that. So on one hand, we were trying to do that. On the other hand, I just think it's delightfully thematic that Gail is literally becoming the sleeper. Like, she's literally becoming the god of her society. And so I find that really interesting too. And I'm really interested in exploring, what does that mean? You know, Gail is now becoming not dissimilar to what Harry was, Dr. Seldon was to Foundation on Terminus. Mm-hmm. For the people on Ignis. And so I'm really interested in exploring that as well.
Just how distributed is Dimmerzell's consciousness? Is that something you'd comment on? Like planetary, solar system?
I can't fully comment on that. Right. That's we're definitely going to get into that in season
three. I didn't think so, but sometimes you shock me. So I thought I'd throw it out there.
Yeah.
All right. How about another random question? And I know this is one that Aaron has personal investment in.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. I got some internet points on the line for this one.
Okay.
The mule's eyes, they're this eerie blue, right? Are those Thespian blue eyes, or are those some kind of augmented mechanical eyes? What are we dealing with here?
What do I want to say? They're not Thespian blue eyes. Thespian eyes are violet. Those
Damn.
Are if you look at the Thespian eyes.
I owe a lot of people in feedback and apology.
Yeah. They're now some of that may come down to like in darker scenes, like the color grading or whatnot. But if you do like a comparison from a still of her in daylight and the mule, and admittedly most of those scenes are at night. His eyes are kind of a lighter, not exactly robin's egg blue when they glow. Hers are really purpley, and his eyes glow when he's exerting his power. So it's sort of like a physical manifestation of the detuned lenses.
Gotcha.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
All right.
But people can see in the final shot.
That having been said, people should expect some interesting surprises with the mule and the provenance of the mule.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a question about decanting. I know a lot of this is probably up to Dimmerzell, but I wonder how much of a clone's memory is returned to them when they are decanted. You mentioned last season they're not aware of the circumstances of the death, but do they stagger out of that chamber blank and then they get an upload? Do they have like some sort of warm-up period before they fully understand who they are? How long is that?
The latter. And the question is whether or not it would be interesting, and maybe one day we'll do it, you know, to really slow down that process and spend, you know, like 20 minutes or even a whole episode with one of those guys being decanted and how they get them up to speed and how much they know or don't know and whether or not they know that they're, I can't remember the word that we used for their predecessors, but
their exponents.
They're exponents. Yeah, whether or not they know that their predecessor died an untimely death or not, or because, and I think it depends on the circumstance. I think sometimes they might know and they're told, okay, this is what happened, but other times they don't know at all. And
would Dimmesdale keep something like the destruction of your entire 20th fleet and you did it from Day, or is that something that she has to pull Day aside and be like, look, your former decantee really mucked things up, or is that part of her statecraft?
She has the latitude to decide, right? Mm-hmm. Because what we're saying there is that she does selectively edit the memories, that she has the latitude to decide what they know and what they don't know and what they're told.
Well, we know that like subsequent generations of Kleons know that, like, was it Kleon the 13th was perceived to kind of mess up the Thespian situation, and they refer back to that as like a mistake, or maybe they didn't go far enough, or maybe it went too far.
I will say this in season three. There's a fair bit of discussion. It was also interesting that a lot of people assumed the genetic dynasty was done at the end of this season. But there's some more story to tell. But I will say in season three, the Kleons of season three are well aware of how much Kleon the 17th bungled everything. They reference it a lot. That's the guy that shit the bed the most.
I thought that was ironically delicious.
Which is going to be on his podium.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wanted to leave his mark. Well, he did.
Yeah, he did. He did.
He did.
Yeah, that's another aside. I thought that you intentionally wrote Day more vulgar this season in every sense of the word. Like, he spoke coarser, he spoke more common, he sounded more like a blowhard executive out of his depth. Was that an intentional choice to give him a little bit less?
Yes.
Okay.
Question. I think this Day 17 was taking the Imperial equivalent of steroids and just, I mean, Day 17 is so far the apple that's fallen furthest from the tree in many ways.
Right. Yeah.
I have some questions around the memory disparity that we saw with the Kleons. Kleon the First has roughly 2.5, three times the memories that these exponents have. Should we understand at this point what exactly is contained within that extra memory space, or is there still more to be revealed? Is it all the Dimmesdale stuff, or is there more?
There's definitely more. And the question will be, how many seasons I have to tell this story? Because there are the events that I know I need to get, that I want through, that I think there's sort of a hierarchy of, A, B, and C stories that I want to tell. And let's say I only have four seasons. I don't know that we'll ever get to that. Now, I'm not saying, you know, because we've only written season three, so we have season four mapped out, but we haven't written it. I'm not saying we couldn't, but then it's a question of, you know, do I have more runway to also fit in some of these tier B and tier C things that, yeah, I would love to do an episode in which we decant a Kleon and go through that entire process of what he knows or doesn't know. If we only have four seasons, I don't know that we'll have the runway to do that.
Yeah, makes sense.
So last season, this is a fun question from last season. I asked if you ever had to fight your science advisors to kind of let you fudge physics to do something cool, and you teased the idea of a planet with a moon orbiting within its atmosphere, and that paid off with the awesome Moonshrike migration. Do you want to tease something similarly mind-blowing for season three? Did you have to go to war with your science advisors to do something cool?
Well, yes. But the thing that people don't take into account is if you're dealing with a level of technology where they have the capacity to create artificial gravity and manipulate gravity, then I think that throws some of these boundaries out the window in terms of, you know, how close a moon can or can't be to a body, how close a civilization could be to the event horizon of a black hole. We're just talking about a level of engineering that's way beyond where we are now. And that, Kevin Hand, who's our science advisor, that's the out, that's the gimme, you know? And sometimes we'll write a little line in that relates to that. And we actually did have an extra line in a Harry backstory on Helicon that mentioned that. But sometimes in the course of the scene, it's like, I don't want to talk about artificial gravity or gravity generators or things like that. So, for a little hint, in season three, Empire does not, they don't have the spacers anymore. So how the hell are they going to get around the galaxy? And we mentioned something in episode two of season two, and that's something that we're going to see. And so when we were getting into constructing that with Kevin Hand, there was definitely one thing that he was kind of hand waving, because we were talking about the different kind of stars we could use to help power, I'll just say, okay. And he was like, oh, it's really got to be this kind of star, and it can be. And I was like, but I don't like that color. So he got into, you know, and he's like, yeah, but that kind of color is not the kind of, you know, gravity or energy output that of the star that you would need. And I'm like, yeah, but I really don't like that color.
You glitched me, said you need a particular type of star for a what? Did you say Stargate?
Oh, a Stargate, yeah.
Okay, I thought so, but it kind of glitched, yeah, so I just want to make sure I got that.
Yeah, they won't be able to get around the galaxy in the same way anymore. And that creates its own unique problems and sort of, I think, story possibilities.
Yeah, that seemed like the biggest development this season, the biggest blow to Empire overall so far. Even more so than Dawn and Seraph being out there with the child, it felt like that was...
For sure, for sure. I mean, if you... And even worse, you know, it's Empire doesn't have traditional jump technology anymore. And that is really how they were able to have the galaxy in an iron grip.
Yeah. Has there been a season three already confirmed? And
no.
Okay.
No, we wrote season three. We've done early prep and design work on season three. You know, we've scouted season three. We're sort of a lot of resources have been put into season three, but it hasn't been confirmed yet.
We had a feedback that was, it wasn't a question for you, but it's an observation that, like, your production, much like the Foundation itself, has had to deal with crises. In season one, it was COVID. In season, you know, into season two, season three, it's the strikes. what's the crisis of season three? Speaking of our listeners, Josh S. wrote in a question saying, in the very first episode's voiceover, Gale lists several people that played key roles, a mathematician, a martyr, and a murderer. I'm wondering, have those roles and people been identified at this point in the show? Mathematician,
yes.
Martyr,
yes.
Murderer.
Yes. Yes, they have.
Gale Salvor the Mule?
Gale Bell the Mule? A lot of possibilities.
Yeah, yes, they've been identified, but there, in some cases, there may be someone that functions as more than one as well. We were cognizant of those three. I like alliteration quite a bit, and we were cognizant of that, and we came up with more than one sort of iteration for what those names could attach to. In my head canon, I know what the three labels attached to, but people can argue it in a bunch of different ways.
Doors wrote in and wants to know some stuff about Demerzel. States, Demerzel states that she was a general in the Robot Wars when she was captured. Isn't Demerzel supposed to be in favor of humanity? I guess I'm just a little worried here. That's supposed to be her thing. Asimovian robots are generally benevolent. Are we going to see the Zeroth Law? Basically asking, are there contradictions in the law here? How is she fighting against humans?
Wow, we really can't answer that one. I will say in episode I believe it was 8, when Dusk and Rue are sitting in front of the mural and he's talking about the robot wars. He says something interesting there, because he says robots against humans, robots against robots. So that implies there's at least two factions of the robots. Sure. And we did say, we said she was a general, or they were a general, because she's not really a woman. Mm-hmm. We didn't say which faction she was a general for. And we didn't, obviously, by design, say why the robots would be fighting amongst one another.
Yeah.
One last thing I'll say is we're certainly not, it would be boring and not interesting. We're certainly not just going to tell, you know, the Terminator story. Okay. I mean, sure. I think aside from the fact
you've already I've done
a version of that, but I think there are more nuanced and interesting. Look, I love Terminator, but in our universe, there are more nuanced and interesting stories to be told. And I think the story that we intend to tell is not one that I've seen a lot of iterations of.
All right. Kimmo has a question. After the assassination attempt on Day, why was Demerzel in such a hurry to save him? Wouldn't they just need to uncork another one if he perishes? Also, why would anyone attempt to assassinate someone who can be decanted indefinitely?
So the way Demerzel's programming works is she's always going to attempt to take the path of least resistance. So the most extreme version of following her programming is killing a Cleon and decanting a new one. That's the most extreme one. So if she can... that's the way her programming works. And I also believe she just personally would prefer, generally speaking, not to do that. Because I do believe that the laws, the new law, the Cleonic law that Cleon the First imposed upon her sits atop the other laws, but the other laws are still there underneath.
Okay.
So killing a Cleon and decanting a new one is the most extreme thing she is permitted to do. But if she can do things like scare a Cleon, if she can do things that will, in this case, deter or mess up, you know, the marriage without having to do something as extreme as killing that Day, then she will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of answers in the finale for this. This question came in obviously before that. So
yes,
I do have a couple follow-ups, because like the other thing about the why would anyone attempt assassination, decantation is still not like widespread public knowledge, right? Like people don't know that if a Cleon dies, they can just bring out another one. They just see that. Okay.
And well, then, also they, you know, I don't believe that assassination attempt was public knowledge. The fact of the matter
is... just the idea that why would anyone try to assassinate someone who could just be right, you know, brought right back.
Sure.
Yeah.
So. Sure. But the other thing I will say is Day was never in any real danger in that assassination attempt, we now know. Sure. I mean, she was sort of orchestrating the whole thing. She was certainly trying to it seem ultimately like Rue and Sereth were behind it, and he would end, you know, the marriage, and she wouldn't have to kill him and decant a new one.
You're listening to Foundation and Podcast. We'll be right back. And we're back. Respect and enjoy the podcast.
We see in the Principium there's all stages of Cleonic embryonic development. Is there a limit to the decantation? Like, do they have off-world backups? Is there how many clones could they burn through before they would be in trouble? Or is it just essentially, as far as you need to know from storytelling purposes, infinite?
I think it's the infinite. I mean, it would certainly seem like bad planning if there was only one decanting facility and it was centralized merely on Trantor. That would certainly seem pretty stupid. You know, we have cloud backups, right? You know, for our data. So that would seem pretty dumb.
Jeff P. wondered, he loves the show Foundation and wants to know, are there planned releases for any physical formats of the show? And if so, are there plans to include extra deleted scenes with special features?
You mean like Blu-ray and whatnot?
Yeah.
Yes. There are, you know, there will be in a limited variety. There, unfortunately, they've got some making of featurettes and things like that in terms of extras. We don't have deleted scenes. We don't have blooper reels. I'm trying to get Apple to release some deleted scenes in some format, and they're open to it. It's just right now we don't have any editors on staff. So a question of how they would be released. There's a couple of pretty cool scenes that we did film that we had to cut out for a variety of reasons that I think people would like to see. And, you know, we may release blooper reels as well. We have blooper reels that we've cut for the crew and cast each season that we show them in the end of filming. And they're fun. And I don't know, I waver back and forth sometimes about whether or not we should show bloopers. I guess people want to see them.
It's the best. I love like running across a random Star Trek The Next Generation blooper, or like the Always Sunny reels are legendary, right? You know, look, I want to see multiple takes of Lee Pace getting bit in the shoulder by Becky, you know, because I had a lot of fun with Lee Pace this year. He was amazing.
There are some funny moments. I mean, crazily, we don't have nearly as many bloopers as you would think, which is... But there are some fun
that's
ones.
Expensive. It's expensive to shoot stuff. So imagine.
But I'm talking to Apple about ways that we can release some deleted scenes, hopefully when the strike's over, potentially blooper reels. I will say I saw someone on Reddit that was talking about whether or not they could download 4K images from the title sequence and whatnot. And I asked Apple about that. And so they gave me the images, but shockingly, Apple didn't have anything set up to host that. So I actually found a site where I can host them, and people will be able to download some 4K wallpaper stuff from my website, which is kind of amazing that I'm having to do it instead of Apple, but Apple gave me the images. So I actually, they're on my website now if people tunnel around through the gallery, but I'll post something in the news section, and I'll post something on Instagram. So there people will be able to get some wallpapers from the show.
And where is that website?
I'm sorry?
And where is that website?
Oh, davidescoyer.com. It's on my website now. I just haven't bothered in the news section to say, hey, by the way, if you want to let this stuff go here.
You just mentioned the Instagram. Last time you said that people were trying to bully you on the Instagram. Apparently the bullying has worked.
Yeah, it's... I've avoided social media, but I definitely have a lot of behind the scenes videos and images and things like that, not just for Foundation, but for other projects. And I realize for the audience that might be fun to share and pull out, you know, as we continue. So I joined Instagram a couple of weeks ago, and I'll continue to post stuff that people can't get anywhere else, you know, in the coming year. And then hopefully, if we go into production on season 3, I'll be posting some casting announcements and whatnot as we get into the making of that.
Awesome.
Oh yeah. My Madison is telling me on my website, I've also released one scene already, but there's another scene that I'm going to release tomorrow. Some scenes that were scripted, but never filmed. people can get that on my website as well. So I already did one for episode 206, and there's a scene that we wrote for 210 that we didn't film. That one really hurt, that we had to cut for budget, and that will be up on my website tomorrow.
All right. Ari asked, the season tease talk of the emperors and the dynasties from the pre-Cleonic period. Can you speak on the collaborative effort of the writers coming up with these past emperors' unique stories all the way through the art department depicting these stories via the beautiful wall murals? Have you thought any, like how much have you thought through the backstories of these murals, essentially?
You know, we do have a kind of in-show Bible timeline. And so we kind of fill them out as needed. And where we can, we've tried to pull emperor names from Asimov's writing.
Sure.
Or glean whatever we can from the writings. And so a lot of them are actually name checked by Asimov himself. A couple we've had to come up with on our own. I'll say two things. It's become apparent as we move forward into 3 and 4 that we're now going to have to, in broad strokes, sketch out from beginning, middle, to end the emperors that preceded the Cleons. Like, we can't just say, oh, well, this guy did this and this guy did that. Like, we actually now have to figure out the framework, because as we delve further into the show, we're going to be unpacking some things that happened before the Cleonic dynasty. So we have to get off our ass and really more properly nail some of that down. And each season, what we tend to do is the mural is miles long. And so I would love to do a shot, and maybe we will one day, where we just do, you know, like a 6-minute scene walking down, you know, with some characters walking down the mural line, just having 6 minutes of material. That's one of my stretch goals for one of the seasons, just to do. But then I have to generate all that art. But each season, what we do is we talk about what are the important plot points that we want depict on the mural. And Rory, Shane, my production designer, and his art team will come up with 6 to 8 depictions of key events that we're going to be referencing. And then every time we go to the sets, we have to reskin the mural with those events. And sometimes the art department has time to reskin them overnight, you know, when we have to come in and shoot a scene or a different scene, and sometimes they don't. So inevitably we get into a situation where we find more than we actually film. And so maybe we say, okay, it's all boring, but we have a whole spreadsheet of like, these are the scenes that we have to film in the mural, and this is when this has to happen. And sometimes, you know, from 2 different episodes, you might have 2 scenes that have 2 different depictions on the mural. Well, that's impossible to film on the same day. It's just a whole Jenga puzzle scheduling nightmare.
I would love to see that 6-minute scene also. That sounds amazing. It sounds like an art department's worst nightmare or a dream to them, right?
It's definitely something that I'm determined to do one day. Yeah.
Yeah. Ruma writes in and says, I was wondering about all the technology that Harry had in season 1 when he left for Terminus. Where did all the money and technology come from to support Harry's mission for his vault and his digital avatar and all this? Was he rich? Did he find this stuff somewhere?
That's a really interesting question, and we can't tell the answer to that. The vault does seem pretty sophisticated, even by galactic standards. Obviously, he got some money from Empire initially when they were exiling them. And I think it's fair to say that some of that money was redirected. I think it's also fair to say that he had some hidden streams of income, and he might have even had some help in building the vault.
Interesting. Okay.
I have some theories about that. Steve S. wants to know.
I would just say it's hard because I like titrating, you know, little hints, but I also just don't want to give away whole storylines for future seasons. So,
how do you decide like what to give away, what not? It seems like it's a fraught process. Yeah. But Steve S. wants to know, when you deviate from the books and weave in new plot lines and characters, what approval, if any, do you need to get from whomever holds the rights to the Foundation? That's Asimov's daughter or granddaughter at this point?
Daughter.
It's her daughter.
Robin, yeah.
Robin, right. Do you have free reign to modify the story as you see fit?
I mean, technically now, legally, we have free reign to do whatever we want, but I respect her tremendously. So, and she's a huge fan of the show, and she doesn't like to watch. She has capacity to watch dailies, but she doesn't like to watch the dailies. She likes to watch the completed episodes with her friends as they're released. And I actually did an interview with her about episode 10 the other day. And the interviewer had seen it, and Robin hadn't yet, because she wanted to watch it when it, so something got spoiled for Robin, which I felt really bad about. But if it's a big change, I pitch it to her, because I just want to see what she thinks and how she feels. Her father, she has a pretty good sense of what her father would have permitted and whatnot, because she had been involved in his life and had become the executor of his estate even before he had died. So they were very close. So anything really big, I would picture.
An incredibly endearing portrait, the idea of his daughter, you know, grabbing a bowl of popcorn with her friends and watching Foundation. That's I just love that.
I mean, know, it's great. And she'll eat me after the episode and say, She's really nice.
Yeah. I think we have only one more question.
Okay.
Have you thought of the dumbest thing that you've heard on the podcast yet? Or do you want to demur?
Well, I thought the dumbest thing was the thespian, the mule's a thespian.
Great. Okay.
Clearly, one's blue and one's purple.
This is the exact. Yeah. Okay. As the person that thought up that question, I got what I deserved.
Yeah. I'm sure there have been some other ones, but that one I was like, that one was crazy.
Got it. Came up
in my mind. Well, but again, we talked about this last time, but we trained the audience to look at every little thing, and there's no question, which is why it's frustrating sometimes when we do screw up something like whether or not a scene should be detuned or not, right? But we went even so far as to, and I haven't seen anyone mention this, but if you look at the shot in episode 9 where Polly is kneeling before the vault and you see the Invictus hitting the earth and sort of grinding up behind him, right before we cut out, there's this bright flash of light that's clearly not coming from the Invictus. And I think it's like a 4-frame flash. And that we put that there, that's the vault scooping Polly up. Mm-hmm. So there's no question that we do get that granular. And so no one apparently even noticed that. And I was surprised that no one would notice it. Maybe someone.
It's funny because we had a powwow about the season with Pete Peppers, and we got to talk, and I'm like, you know what? I'm actually going to, because I swore Pauly, I saw those Earths, and we on the podcast, I went back and watched, and I'm like, God damn it. They actually did put something there at the very end where
we did.
You can't
we did.
Say Pauly yeah. was swallowed up by the Earth. But man, yeah, no, I actually like that. That's where I thought is the finale is interesting to find out, go back. And I think rewatching the season is going to be incredibly rewarding too, to see how all these pieces fit. And just how much it plays off all the themes. Like, I just think it's fundamentally beautiful. The fact that like Gale, the psycho historian, had this huge plan to save everyone that was foiled by her daughter taking individual action. And if she hadn't, they would all died. Like, that's just so the show in a nutshell.
I'm trying to make a show that will bear repeated viewings. I'm trying to make a show where, even to the point of Pelis 1, Pelis 2, right? You know, you said that
skins.
It means hide and what is, or pelt, and what does Hobart do? But he pierces Empire's hide. So we try to throw out all those extra allusions and Easter eggs and things like that, and hope and people seem to be scooping a lot of them up. And then sometimes they scoop them up in second or third viewings, but that's the kind of show that I try to make. And I think look, people can disagree with some of the choices we made, but I think if one were to go back and watch season two, it's pretty intricately plotted. You know what I mean? And we try to really, this meant that this happened, and in ways that may not even be immediately apparent upon first viewing. And so I don't know. I'm curious to see. I know that a lot of people are really going to like episode 10, and I'm also going to take some heat for episode 10. But it sounds like that's where you guys were, or at least initially.
Yeah. I think we only have a sample size of three, but all three of us were like, had the reaction of like, oh my God, you know. But like, I think almost every, even Jim, I think you're the one that's like still a little feeling a little like, you stole my car, dude.
Just on a certain aspect, but. But,
yeah, and I think honestly,
it's fine.
And the detuned lenses, this guy would be happy as pig in slop if he hadn't paid, you paid too much attention to detuned lenses.
Wow. But that's, great. That's the kind of viewer we want. But we let you down there. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Sorry. I would say congratulations on a very much, much improved season two. I think you guys did an excellent job overall in this season, you know, squabbles about the certain parts of finale aside. Enjoyed this season.
It's epic. It feels big and important. The performances and the characters are just wonderful. The show looks, I know you guys don't have the biggest budget and like the monster television shows, but like I could tell from what gets on the screen. Every season you have completely impressed me with like some crazy new visual, like dropping a black hole on a planet, you know?
Right.
I just couldn't believe how beautiful Sereth's personal skiff was, just how well designed. Right. And you know, you could tell that someone's thought a lot about like what type of person the Cloud Dominion, and expressing all that in just what, 10 seconds of a ship flying through space. So
we sweat the details. I have an incredible crew, incredible cast, incredible writers. Everyone's super passionate about it. We sweat the details. And, you know, I also, it's very gratifying to me to see the people debating, not just did this happen or that happen, but the sort of secondary and tertiary debates about free will or the laws or all of that. I just think that's cool. That's the kind of show that I enjoy watching. And it's the kind of show that as a fan, I enjoy participating in. And so that's just neat to me. So hopefully we can keep doing it. And I can't promise that we won't do some things that will irk you, because we try to take big swings, you know?
Oh, that's apparent. That is apparent.
So.
Well, you've got the website, davidesquire.com, your Instagram. Is there anything else coming up that you want the fans to know about? Of course, probably a lot of free time, I imagine. But is there anything coming up that you do want people to know about?
We've got the coffee table book coming out, Making a Foundation, The Art of Foundation. I think it's October 3rd through Titan Books. You can order it on Amazon now, but I'd prefer people to order it on bookshop.org. Which donates.
Oh, no. I got my copy on Target.com.
I know. All right. That's okay. Bookshop.org donates a certain percentage to independent booksellers. So, and there are deals in place for more merchandise for Foundation as well. Nothing specific that I can mention, but hopefully in the next 6 to 8 months, you'll be seeing more of that as well. And then otherwise, I'm doing a lot of downtime and thinking about another project that we'll see if it comes to fruition or not. Enjoying talking to you guys.
Well, we appreciate how generous you've been with your time, answering all of our questions, clarifying things throughout the season. It's a pleasure to watch your show. I've had a lot of fun. Can't wait. So I have one more wrap-up show to talk with the fans. We're obviously going to be debating a lot of stuff, but just really looking forward to season three. Looking forward to that.
Me too.
One of the early things to come back, hopefully.
Me too. I can't wait.
Well, congratulations on a successful season two. Good luck with the strike and season three and all the other irons you got in the fire. And yeah, I hope we can talk soon. But thanks for coming on our show.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, guys.
See you, David. Well, there you have it, folks. Right from the horse's mouth, David Goyer's thoughts on this season. Now the only thing left is to hear yours. We are going to do at least one more, perhaps two, if there's enough material, wrap-up podcast. We're going to be joined by our buddy from YouTube, Pete Peppers, to kind of break down our thoughts about the finale and the season. And we'll also have your feedback. Send that in to foundation@baldmove.com, and we will be considering it on the season wrap-up podcast out next week. You can also follow along with us if this is your terminus point for our foundation coverage. If you want to find out what else we're doing right now, the best place is to look on our socials, at baldmove everywhere except for TikTok. We're at baldestmove there. In particular interest, I think, for sci-fi fans, we got Loki coming up. That might be interesting. There's a lot of interesting timey-wimey, free will, predestination questions there. What's another one that maybe sci-fi fans would be interested in, Jim?
Daryl Dixon. I don't know.
Yeah. if you want to see how far a dynasty has fallen into decrepitude and decay, check us out there. We got a bunch of other stuff too. Fargo, True Detectives around the corner. Check us out there. And then if you want to support what we're doing here, keep our podcast podding, support.baldmove.com is how you get that, and ad-free feeds, a ton of other bonus features. Thanks for listening. We'll be back on the wrap-up podcast. Until next week, I'm your host, Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Respect and enjoy the podcast.